That's right. Now it's time to talk to journalist and author Rod Lyle, discussing his remarkable new book, The Club: Empire, Power and the Governance of World Cricket. Rod joins us. Are you in Perth or Melbourne, Rod?
I'm in Sydney.
Yeah, right. Okay. One out of three.
Yeah.
Rod, it is a remarkable piece of work, an incredible piece of history. I'll use it as a point of reference for many years to come, and I will read it more slowly and at my leisure, not necessarily at my pleasure, over many years. But I read it very, very quickly this weekend, and I have to say that I've got so many questions, but I think it'd be probably better if you set the agenda. All I would say is that I'm very grateful that I now finally understand some of the historical reasons for the mess international cricket finds itself in 2025.
Yeah, alas, that is so true. And I guess that was in a way the motivation for writing the book. I actually first wrote a short 3,000 word unofficial history of the ICC for the Cricket Europe website 15 years ago, in the middle of the great fight over the 10 team full member only World Cup. And I found myself asking exactly the same question. How did we come to be where we are? And then at the back end of COVID, Tim Brooks, who's also written very interestingly on international cricket, and I were chatting about the fact that there wasn't a book about the history of the ICC, and we decided to write it together. But then Tim decided also after that that he had other priorities and in his writing. And so I took the thing on myself. But it is exactly that. It is an attempt to come to terms with what is, I think, a repeatedly tragic history of mismanagement.
I mean, has the ICC ever changed their mismanagement of governing cricket? In the book, there's a quote in there that says their strategy, so it's like advice given to airline passengers: hold your head in your hands and pray the crash won't be too horrific. That's been the story of the ICC. I don't think that's ever changed.
No, I think the forms of it have changed. It starts as an imperialist project to bring the white empire together, and it maintains that position for the best part of 80 years. And we've seen then this extraordinary reversal where, as it has become more professional and as more money has come into the game, the incompetence of not, yeah, maybe not just incompetence, but also the willful mismanagement of Australia and England, and in the early days, South Africa, has been replaced by the, I think, even more malevolent role of the BCCI and its allies, with England and Australia still managing to keep their hands on the tiller and on some of the money. It's changed in form, but the underlying story of just terrible governance has essentially remained the same.
Yeah, exactly. There are so many examples of this self-serving governance. At one point, Rod, you write, it remains an open secret that the annual returns of player and official number competitions, clubs and facilities, which the associate members are required to submit, are often hyperbolic and in some cases closer to fiction than reality. So that's at the lower levels, and we talk often about how the associate nations are struggling. And you say that they've got the hand in the cookie jar anyway. And then we fast forward to the Wolf Report in 2011, independent review of the governance of international cricket. Somebody from the Wolf Report spoke to me, believe it or not, and I was full of hope that the game might actually change. It was full of wonderful recommendations, and I really thought that somebody might listen. It turns out they all did listen and ran for the hills. A couple of years later, we had the breakaway of the big three, India, Australia, and England, saying that everybody should look after themselves and be able to be financially independent. Like, as Hami said, you just want to hold your head in your hands.
No, absolutely. I mean, the comment about the chicanery involved in the annual returns, I think, needs to be contextualized. That's true. But it's also true that the full members are not subject to any managerial, actuarial, financial control whatsoever. They can do what they like with the money that the ICC gives. I think that is undoubtedly true. Gideon Hay, in his review of the book, talks about the wolf exercise as a Hail Mary. Even at the time, he says he thought it was a Hail Mary. It seemed like a Hail Mary because it was obvious that this wasn't going to go anywhere. If it came up with any recommendations which were halfway sensible, they would immediately be vetoed by the people with the power. And of course, that's what happened. And that is one of those tragic moments where cricket was at a crossroads and it chose the wrong path. And it's gone on choosing that path and getting further and further down that path in the what, 12, 13 years since.
Rod, having studied the history, I mean, I know that, history as we understand it is a study and an understanding of the past, but it also gives you a very rare ability to look at the future. Given that history has repeated itself so often, I want you to look into the future and tell us if there's any hope. I mean, the T20 franchise market world is out of control, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you look at the last chapter of the book, it's a pretty bleak read, I have to say. I'll hold up my hand and admit that. But on the other hand, I mean, in an interesting piece of synchronicity, just a few days before the book was published in England, the World Cricketers Association issued their report on the future of cricket. And while I have a lot of reservations about it, and I wouldn't describe it as Wolf 2.0. At the same time, it contains a lot of sense and it contains a lot of the same criticisms, some different solutions, but on the financial side, they are in no doubt that the current regime, where the lion's share of the money goes to the BCCI, on the grounds that they bring it in and therefore they ought to get it back. And no attention is paid to the actual needs of world cricket. It's crumbs from the rich man's table. And the other full members are being shafted just as much as the associates are, or nearly as much. So no attention is paid to what cricket actually needs, what the development of cricket actually needs in terms of the distribution of money. And then on top of all of that, you have, as you say, the franchises, which represent, it seems to me, a huge threat to traditional international cricket. Does that matter? Would anybody care if the number of countries playing Test cricket, as the new CEO of Cricket Australia recently suggested, were to be cut to, who knows what, four, six countries? Some people's minds are working in that direction. Let's have more franchise cricket and less of the old fuddy-duddy test cricket, which I happen to think is the highest form of the game. So the players have an interest in encouraging the growth of franchise leagues because that's where the money is. And so the World Cricketers Association report wants to reduce the number of, wants to have windows for international cricket, but as few of them as possible and as short as possible, with the rest of the time open to what they call the free market. And of course, one of the problems that we've had for at least 20 years and maybe more is that cricket administrators no longer think in terms of cricket. They think in terms of markets. The whole IS Bindra China USA thing, which I talk about in the book, is aimed not at growing cricket in China or possibly even in the USA, which tends to be a basket case anyway, but to grow the viewing numbers, the following numbers, and thereby the amount of money that can be generated from media contracts. That's all that matters. And that is not an attitude which is characteristic of a governing body worthy of the name.
You're listening to Rod Lyle, author of The Club, Empire, Power and the Governance of World Cricket. You can buy Rod's new book out in all good bookstores. You're listening to Following On here on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, alongside Durham Hall of Famer Steve Harmison. We're continuing our chat with Rod Lyle, author of The Club, Empire, Power and the Governance of World Cricket, which is, to put in simple terms, an explainer of the history behind many of the problems that the game finds itself in at the moment and why it isn't able to administer and control itself in the way that football can, Rod. FIFA, I mean, it all goes back to the history and the establishment of the International Cricket Conference, as it was back in the 1930?
1908, 1909. Yeah, I mean, I think that is a really interesting contrast, not only with FIFA, but also with the IOC, with international organizations in which the French played an instrumental role. And I think one of the problems, although the only other time that cricket has been in the Olympics was in the Paris Olympics of 1900, but the fact is that cricket was not taken seriously in France in the early 1900s. And as we said earlier, the initiative to create the Imperial Cricket Conference was a project which originated in South Africa with a Bailey, who was a mining magnate, who had the bright idea that we could use cricket to bind together the empire. And by the empire, he meant the white empire. So it was Australia, England, and South Africa. And his project was essentially a triangular tournament, which happened once in 1912 and was, to put it mildly, not a huge success, and had taken place kind of over the dead bodies of the Australian cricket administrators who didn't want to be involved in it in the first place. And the idea was clearly, from the evidence, to keep the ICC as powerless as possible. It was to be concerned with arranging future tours among those three countries, which were the only countries who were allowed to play test cricket at that point. And significantly, it met twice every English summer to allow time for the delegates to refer back to their boards to check to see whether what they were agreeing to was what the board was prepared to agree to. And that's a practice which keeps going for quite a long time, that the ICC has no real decision-making power. They start gradually to involve themselves in umpiring, and surprisingly early in questions of corruption, in this case, corruption of umpires, and other broader issues, but always in the context of we can only decide this once our board has given us the green light. And the boards developed very clever techniques of saying, well, we haven't had time, even though you put this question to us 3 years ago, we haven't had time to discuss it yet, but we'll let you know. Don't call us, we'll call you. So the ICC has had, in that form, minimal decision-making power. And that continues really up to the big reconstruction, which takes place at the end of the 1980s, and in some ways even beyond that. So you get journalists commenting on the fact that, and some administrators commenting on the fact that the ICC never makes a decision, or never makes a decision until it really has to. And if you look, for example, at Bodyline, the way the ICC managed to not make a decision really about anything to do with Bodyline, of course, one of the problems was that the MCC, the Marylebone Cricket Club, was running the ICC from a desk at Lord's, and they were one of the parties to the Bodyline dispute. So they had an interest in making sure that Australia and South Africa didn't get a chance to say, you've been very naughty boys. But that's kind of the history in miniatures. That's how it goes. And if you compare policies on membership, for example, or indeed on decision-making powers, or on finance, yes, FIFA, the IOC, which are defective bodies in many ways. And at one point in the book, I talk about World Rugby, which is another interesting example. Again, France, being a major rugby nation, has a voice in that. And when you look at they are not perfect organizations, but they're a hell of a lot better than the mess that passes for the governance of world cricket.
Yeah, it's interesting that ICC, you say started making decisions. I don't think they've started yet. So, they've been going for 120 odd years. There's time for them. So hopefully they will do in a future, because I think the landscape is quite frightening in the game from a governance point of view. You mentioned South Africa, Rod, just a second ago, and talking about World Cups. There's a sliding doors moment, around apartheid. Would World Cups have come about if that aren't happening? And then even fast forwarding it to sort of modern day, when you talk about, South Africa sliding door moment. I think in 2007, India and Pakistan were knocked out. The decision not to have associate nations involved in World Cups then as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, apartheid was a huge test, and I think we are still suffering in many ways for the line that Australia and England and New Zealand took over playing South Africa after South Africa left the Commonwealth. The rules of the ICC said that in order to be a member of the ICC and in order to play Test cricket, you had to be a member of the Commonwealth. And when South Africa became a republic and left the Commonwealth in 1961, that technically meant that they could no longer play Test cricket. And England and Australia and New Zealand said, we don't care about that. We're going to play them and we're going to regard them as full tests. And then you get the rebel tours, you get prolonged negotiations with South Africa trying to get them back in. The ICC sends a delegation to review progress towards multiracial cricket in South Africa. And whatever view you take, and it is a very, very complex issue, whatever view you take on the rights and wrongs of using cricket in the battle for change in South Africa, and I know there are honestly held opinions on all sides about that, but the fact is that the resentment which England, Australia, and New Zealand built up in the ICC with the West Indies and India and Pakistan, as the six then were, are, I think, still echoing in the attitude of many people in cricket administration around the world. There are people who have still not forgiven the white countries for the line they took over South Africa. And that may fuel some of the determination to exact a post-colonial revenge from the BCCI and its allies.
Rod, I've had a small taste a couple of times of the dedication it requires to write a book, although I never have never tackled anything as vast as this. Congratulations. It's an extraordinary read, and as I said,
Thank you very much, Jim.
it answers a lot of questions that I've had for many decades. Congratulations.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's Rod Lyall, author of The Club, Empire, Power and the Governance of World Cricket. Absolutely fascinating read.